The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings.
Our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us?
Exopolitics, paranormal phenomena, and deep analysis of current world events from somewhere in the desert between Area 51 and Roswell, blasting across the planet, the Manticore Network proudly presents Veritas, because the truth will set you free.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
It was too fast to be an airplane.
I think it's time to open the books on the question of government investigations of UFOs. We ought to do it really because it's right. We ought to do it because the American people, quite frankly, can handle the truth. And we ought to do it because it's the law.
Be skeptical. Do be as skeptical as you want, but by all, don't close your mind.
Greetings to everyone around the world, and a warm welcome to another edition of Veritas, where we uncover the truth, one guest at a time. For those of you who dare to seek, Veritas is the place where you shall find. I'm your host, Mel Fabregas, and I sincerely thank you for joining me once again. And if this is your first time, make yourself at home. I want to thank all our members. As always, you are keeping Veritas alive. Tonight's special guest is Dr. Brooks Agnew. HARP, Earthquakes, 2012, and the Hollow Earth. This will be such a fascinating show, and I'm confident you will enjoy it. Dr. Brooks Agnew will be with us shortly. To listen to this full show, simply head on over to our website and subscribe. For only $7 per month, you'll get access to this, all our past and future shows, 64 so far. You will also receive access to the Manticore Forum and the Veritas chat room. For only 20 cents per day. Where else can you get real knowledge without any commercial interruptions? Nowhere else. It only takes a few seconds, and you can download and take Veritas with you. And this is the last call about the upcoming International UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada. I will be there and hope to meet any of you who will be attending. For more information, visit our website and click on the International UFO Congress banner. I hear my friend Paul Harris will allow me to introduce myself and Veritas during her presentation. Thank you, Paula. I will also attempt to interview some of these speakers and will share audio and maybe even video with you. Stay tuned. And I want to apologize to you. Although I've received a lot of praise for last week's show with Richard Dolan, the sound quality did not meet your expectations or mine. As you know, I'm always looking for ways to improve on everything. And sound is one of the most important aspects of this show. As we broadcast in 128 kilobytes per second, which is the equivalent of CD quality. However, sometimes even using Skype, the guests may not hear themselves, and it was too late to correct after the interview was over. I will make sure we do more testing prior to the interview starting, and if we have to go back to the traditional telephone lines, we will do so. In the meantime, please bear with me. Veritas is always work in progress, and you're part of it. And by the way, it was such a great interview. If you go past the technical aspects of the T's and the P's, because Richard has his microphone so close to his mouth, it was an excellent show from an excellent guest. That's why I call him my favorite UFO historian. I have some news regarding the blogosphere. If you are a blogger and would like to collaborate and be included on the list of Veritas news sources, get in touch with me so we can give you access to our blog. Our very first collaborator is my friend Andre Heath from the Alien Project. Andre is from Jamaica and he has been producing high quality videos related to all the topics we discuss here. As a matter of fact, he was the winner of the Veritas video contest last year. He continues to send me videos and news all the time, so I thought, why don't we start doing this? Let's open the door of our blog to qualified and reputable bloggers like Andre. So if you, again, are a blogger and are interested in collaborating with us, send me an email to mail@veritasshow.com. We will review your blog and get in touch with you. This is on a voluntary basis. We will list your link on our blog as well, and occasionally we will feature your contributions on the air and we'll give you credit. For more news, visit our blog or the Manticore Forum, which is where the juicy stuff really resides. And now, get ready for a fascinating 2 hours. Is HAARP capable of causing earthquakes and manipulating the weather? Did you know our guest is organizing the greatest geological expedition in the history of the world? The North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. Is the Earth really hollow? What kind of world lives under our feet? Are you ready for 2012? And do you want answers? This and much more with Dr. Brooks Agnew, who's coming up next. If you want to believe, stop this audio now. If you want to know, don't go anywhere. This is Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to Veritas. Great music you hear right here on the Veritas Show is supplied by the independent artists from Jamendo.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to our homepage, VeritasShow.com, click on the guest, look up the song, and download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases right there at Jamendo.com.
This is Richard Dolan, and you're listening to The Veritas Show.
Dr. Brooks A. Agnew grew up in Pasadena, California, around JPL and Caltech. He entered the Air Force in 1973, where he graduated top in his class in electronics engineering. He was one of the most successful scientists with ground probing radar technology in the nation for oil and gas exploration. Similar technology is currently utilized in the Mars Express program. He received his bachelor's in chemistry from Tennessee Technological University with honors. He is the author of thousands of technical papers, seminars, documentaries, or books on precision measurement and exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of Earth. He is the host of X Squared Radio, one of North America's most widely listened to internet paranormal radio programs. He is the co-author of the Ark of Millions of Years trilogy that has been critically acclaimed as the most comprehensive publication ever written on the 2012 end times. He is also the expedition leader of the greatest civilian expedition in history to the Arctic Circle to examine the theory that planets form as hollow spheres. The team's hypothesis was Japan's Genes of Galileo winner in 2007. He is currently the president of Sirius Energies Corporation, building electric vehicles. And I'm proud to introduce to you teacher, scientist, talk show host, but most of all, Earth explorer, Dr. Brooks Agnew. Hello, Dr. Agnew, and welcome to Veritas. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing wonderful. Thank you for having me on.
It's my pleasure. Dr. Agnew, you were on the list of prospective guests for this year. However, after the January 12th Haiti earthquake, many people started mentioning your name and I thought it would be an appropriate time. So I appreciate your being with us in such short notice. First of all, for those who may not be familiar with you, and before we start discussing the many topics at hand, I want you to recount how you accidentally triggered an earthquake by using radio waves to locate underground oil, which is what triggered, no pun intended, this interview.
Well, one of the observations that we made back in the mid-80s, I believe this was in 1987, we were surveying for a gas well in Oregon, and we had worked in this area a couple of days, surveying and getting ready to lay it out and make sure that wherever we were looking, we had the permits to drill for the landowner and things like that. So I had set up my lab inside of a camper on the back of a pickup truck, a one-ton pickup truck, and we had a mobile broadcasting unit that was mounted to an all-terrain vehicle. One morning, as we began our broadcasting regimen, which is where we lay out a radiometric grid of the property to basically map the substrata under the ground using radio waves, kind of like underground sonar, as it were. And we sent the mobile unit out, and he was about 3/8 of a mile away from the camper. We were in communication by two-way radio, and he got into position where we had previously surveyed along a fault line, and I asked him to go ahead and turn his broadcast unit on. I had my receiving antenna pointed in his direction, and just a few seconds after I asked him to do that, an earthquake occurred, and it just shook the camper pretty good. It was probably a 5 or so on the Richter scale. And I called out to him on the radio and said, hey, what was that? And he said, I don't know. He said, I turned on the broadcast unit, and about a second and a half, 2 seconds later, I heard a loud bang under the ground, almost directly underneath me, and then the ground shook. And I said, yeah, we heard it shake over here. And it wasn't dynamite or anything like that. We were on a grass farm up in Oregon. So there was no blasting, no road work, nothing like that going on. So I said, wow, that's really strange. Did we do that? And he said, I don't know, but it was like I turned it on and bam, it happened. So I made a note in my lab notebook, and I just didn't pay any attention to it. We went on with the survey, and we finished the job. It wasn't until 1997 that I was approached by a documentary team that was doing a research project on HARP, which is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project. I had written several papers on ground probing radar, and the internet was just then making high-speed access into homes, and they had found my paper, and they asked me to be a contributing scientist on the documentary. And when I saw what HARP was, what frequencies they were playing with, and what power levels they were playing with, I said, hey, you know, you really have to be careful with that, because you can trigger an earthquake. And everybody looked up at me like, hey, we already know that, but how did you know that? And I said, I told them, recounted what happened 10 years before up there in Oregon. And so we started going through all the data, and I was assigned to do calculations on what's called an ionospheric breakdown. It's also called a solar tap, and the weather warfare aspects of HARP. But that earthquake aspect of HARP, because it uses ELF waves, which are extremely low frequency, high amplitude waves that can resonate with strata under the ground. And if there's a propensity for an earthquake, like tensions are built up in the ground, then it may be able to cause that earthquake to happen almost on command. Now, the interesting thing about Haiti, I got to thinking, why in the world would anyone trigger an earthquake in Haiti? It has no strategic value. It doesn't have any oil. We don't have any enemies there. Why would they do that? And then somebody mentioned to me that Haiti had not had an earthquake of any significance in over 200 years.
1751.
So 1951?
No, 1751.
Well, that's still a long time. So evidently it was someplace close enough and you know, on target that they could demonstrate whether they could cause an earthquake or not. Then it was discovered that there was a what we call a HARP signature, because the carrier frequencies that HARP uses are in the 2-meter band and can be picked up by ham operators around the world. And there was a HARP signature just prior to the Haiti earthquake.
A lot of people have questions about this. As you said, what is the strategic need of us being there? But let me just read something quickly to the audience so that they have an idea of something. The United States has constructed its fifth largest embassy in the world in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Fifth, only besides the U.S. embassy in China, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Germany, in tiny Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. What would we need such a large embassy in Haiti, Dr. Agnew, if it wasn't because we see a future in which we may see a much larger American presence there?
You know, that's a very deep political question, and I know that the southern part of the United States isn't very well secured. We have half the border that is occupied, or at least joined up to, by what many people call a third world country, at least the northern part seems to be. And mm-hmm. we have a lot of infiltration coming into our country from that way. We also have fairly unmonitored coastlines along that area, and for 50 years we have been plagued by boat people, as it were, coming, you know, to our shore, basically doing free commerce all along the southern shore of our country, because it's very sparsely populated except for the main city areas. So it would make sense that we would have some way of controlling the warm water side of our country by controlling the island of Cuba and some of the related areas. We know that Castro's reign is coming to an end. We know that Cuba is wanting to go more modern, and that's basically all I know about the politics. It doesn't make much sense to me that we would have an embassy so large unless we had tremendous spying capabilities from that region.
And I understand. I don't want to put you on the spot on the political realm, because I know you're more of a scientist, but we have Puerto Rico. It's a territory. We have plenty of U.S. bases there. We've been practicing in the island of Vieques for years. And again, we don't want to make this show a political show, but we already have several facilities in Puerto Rico. And now I've heard from other scientists that there's discovery of oil reserves in Haiti. So who knows? That could be. Okay, so indeed, if these technologies are available and perhaps being used, Dr. Agnew, could this have been used also in Sichuan, China as well?
It certainly could have. You know, Sichuan is an area of about 200 million people. It has some manufacturing capability, although it's mostly in the city of Sichuan. The province is really densely populated, but isolated from the rest of China, and it's, you know, quite mountainous and rainy and all of that. It's also subject to, or at least has had a history of tectonic activity. So, you know, anything, it seems like anything that we can do to destabilize our enemies or our competitors by creating or at least wishing for natural disasters in their countries, that seems to be strategic for the United States. The thing about HARP is it really is a weapon with no fingerprints.
Plausible deniability, isn't it?
Sure, yeah. And whether you're steering a hurricane, or whether you're causing a tsunami, or whether you're causing an earthquake, it's really difficult to point the finger at anybody because it sounds so fairy tale.
So in other words, you don't even need to drop a bomb to win a war. You could actually use weather war or weather manipulation to do this. But by the way, in your, let's call it an experiment in the 80s that caused the, or you believe it caused that earthquake in Oregon, did you try to replicate it? Did you turn on the system again to see if it would happen again?
Yeah, I mean, I used the system in 9 different states, in California, Texas, Kentucky, Tennessee, Kansas, and even in Pennsylvania. Most of these areas are not tectonically active, but I never had it happen again. And we did it, you know, thousands of times over the years.
But in Oregon, once you tried it and the person who was assisting you said, after a second after I turned it on, I felt a bang. What would have happened if he would have done it again?
Well, by then the tension would have been released underneath the ground. And mind you, we were only using between 30 and 50 watts. HAARP uses a billion watts. So it's quite an intense vibration.
So potentially, with that amount of wattage, what is a worst-case scenario? Can you actually, and I don't want to give anybody any ideas, but can you point that to, let's say, the caldera at Yellowstone and create something huge?
Yes, sure. That's definitely within range of HAARP. The thing that is most effective about HAARP, and it's probably one of the main reasons that it was invented in the first place by Bernard Eastland, it was to shape artificially the ionosphere. It's in the industry called an ionospheric heater. And it just more or less blows a bubble out into space by pushing the ionosphere artificially out. And that forms a parabolic mirror off of which they can bounce the ELF waves, which are amplitude modulated. And it's artificially manipulates what we call the Marconi effect, which is sometimes you'll be driving along in Texas and you'll hear an AM station out of Chicago. Even though it's a yes. long ways away, it bounces off the ionosphere and can be picked up. Not always, but sometimes. And that not always is what was not acceptable to the military, because they send coded instructions to their submarines, which, as you know, don't put large antennas up in the air. They drag them behind the submarines so they can do so clandestinely. And they communicate in coded, extremely low-frequency waves. Over the horizon, it's unreliable to send those missions or send those messages to submarines. So they artificially shape the ionosphere to make that message sending process much more reliable. And the side effects of what they do by pushing the ionosphere out into space is it causes the stratosphere to move to fill in the hole. When that happens, it redirects the jet stream and can move weather. So that became one of the studies that they perform with HAARP.
So this pertains to the reach of HAARP, which relies on the ionosphere to reflect the frequencies back down to the surface. If the earthquakes in Sichuan and Haiti were triggered by HAARP, pretending that it was, how close does a HAARP installation need to be positioned from the target sites?
Well, you lose energy based on the square of the distance. However, the distance all the way around the Earth is, at that altitude, is probably around 30,000 miles. This is nothing for HAARP to reach. If they can actually get a standing wave to aim at that point, there's no place on Earth that it can't reach.
So for those who wonder where this may have come from, everybody thinks of Alaska, but look at Google Puerto Rico Arecibo Observatory. We may think it's a radio telescope, but in actuality, I've heard that it's also a HAARP facility. Could the proximity between Puerto Rico and Haiti have been a factor, being so close, if indeed there's a HAARP facility there?
Yeah, you know, I really hadn't thought about it. And the Arecibo dish is a way different unit than the HAARP unit. The HAARP unit is a complex made, what's called a phased array, and it is a stack, an arrangement of square wave antennas, which they can manipulate based on power levels and frequencies and the tilt of those antennas. Arecibo is a parabolic dish, so it's going to make a very focused beam, and it's not going to be as directional as HAARP would be.
I see. So in the May 2008 Sichuan earthquake, colorful, let's call them earthquake clouds, were observed hours prior to the disaster, accompanied by the mass exodus of toads, hundreds of thousands in the province of Sichuan. Scientifically, is HAARP known to be capable of altering the light spectrum emitted from the clouds?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. That's where it got its name, the Auroral Research Project, because when they first started experimenting with it, because the frequency range that they deal with it in, It energizes the ionosphere to the point where the molecules, you know, they're very sparsely arranged up in the ionosphere because of the lack of density. they have no way to dispense their energy other than light. And so the aurora that is can actually be created as far south as the equator if the harp frequencies can be aimed at that portion of the ionosphere. It tends to light up that part of the sky. That is one of the telltale signs that your area is being irradiated by a harp frequency.
So, in layman's terms, just to put things in practical terms for those of us who are not scientifically oriented as you are, take us from a scenario, if we wanted to create an earthquake and with the clouds and so on, what would it take us to the process, if you know how to do that?
Well, you would first have to push the ionosphere out, depending on where you wanted to aim it, and then you would have to lace the ELF waves over it. Now, the ELF and ULF are extremely low and ultra-low frequencies. They can get all the way down to 1.5 cycles per second, up to about 7.8, 9 cycles a second, something like that. Those frequencies, if they're tuned just correctly, and sometimes I guess you could scan through it and then hope for a resonance feedback. If it's left on for several minutes, what happens is that these vibrations sympathetically begin to resonate inside the Earth, deep within the Earth, because these long waves can penetrate several thousand feet into the Earth, sometimes miles into the Earth. And then those substrata begin to oscillate based on the frequency that they're being bombarded with. Now, this is a very small amount of energy, but it's a small amount of energy at exactly the right frequency. And what happens is a phenomenon called constructive interference. And this is sort of like when you play tetherball and the ball comes around and you hit the ball over and over and over again at exactly the right moment. The ball goes faster and faster and faster and faster until finally it winds up on the pole. Nikola Tesla almost destroyed a bridge with a small eccentric wheel that he had tuned to the resonant frequency of the bridge. And when he turned it on, nothing happened at first. But within a couple of hours, the bridge was oscillating so violently, it was about to fall into the river. And they made him turn it off.
That was not in Colorado, was it?
No. No, that was in, I believe, Boston.
That was a different act from Tesla. Are the harp frequencies within the audible range of certain species, and can you provide a few examples if available?
Yes, they are in the audible range. The harp frequencies can go from about 6,800 hertz, which is certainly audible by humans, all the way down into the sub-frequencies. Humans typically outdoors can hear down to about 25 to 28 hertz, something like that. If they're in an enclosed area with no interference sounds, they can hear down to about 20 cycles per second. But once you get below 20 cycles per second, they're not audible. But they are sensed by the body. Harp frequencies are used in the battlefield on a routine basis. They're called non-lethal weapons. They're used to irradiate sections of town where they want to incapacitate the insurgents or whoever it is that they want to subdue. They will irradiate the area for about 30 to 40 minutes, and it can cause uncontrollable diarrhea. It can cause tremendous anxiety. It can cause psychosis, sleeplessness, vomiting, blindness. It can be tuned almost to the point where you hear voices and you see hallucinations. They use this during the Gulf War, and the enemy was so weakened after 30 days of being irradiated on a regular basis that they had not slept literally in weeks, and they just poured out of the bunkers with their hands in the air, even though they weren't being fired upon, because they were driven insane by the frequencies they were being bombarded with.
Doctor, this begs the question then, if this technology is available, and as you mentioned, the Gulf War, where they were just given up, I remember, are you referring to Gulf War One or Two?
Gulf War One. Yeah, HARP mm-hmm. was fully operational in the late 80s.
Okay, so Gulf War One. If that's the case, why wouldn't we be using this more often just to mitigate it and minimize the casualties on our side if we could actually get the enemy out of their holes, if you will?
Well, I can tell you that they do use HAARP frequencies on the ground. They have mobile units that are mounted to trucks. They have focused dishes on them, and they use it on a routine basis in Iraq.
I guess I was referring to Tora Bora. I was referring to the border, the porous border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, if you know what I mean, and who we're trying to smoke out. And we have not smoked them out, which sometimes we wonder if it's on purpose to keep them alive so that we can perpetuate the war. But that's, again, that's another political question, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it doesn't make much sense to continue a war if you catch the bad guys, does it?
Exactly. So within the academia, is there any plan or effort to form a citizen watch group, so to speak, to monitor any potential accidental release of HAARP that you know of?
Well, I know that Dr. Nick Begich out of Alaska, myself, Gene Manning, others have been activists. In some form or another, because we still have to carry on our normal lives.
Sure.
To try to at least get some kind of civilian oversight. I know True TV, the first episode of Conspiracy Theories with Jesse Ventura, they invited me to build a HAARP experiment for that program, which I did.
I saw that.
That program had, I think, pretty close to 2 million people watching it, which was really good for a cable channel, off channel like True TV. Jesse did a wonderful job bringing the importance of this to the common person right in their households. We haven't seen the last of the ramifications of that, but we at least want to get some kind of civilian oversight because they don't really understand what they're playing with there. And if they trigger a cataclysmic event like an allergic reaction, as it were, by the ionosphere, form a solar tap or something, where the ionosphere's got a tremendous amount of energy in it. I mean, just more than you can imagine. If it ever discharged to ground, which is where we are, each bolt would be something like 2.7 megatons, which is about equivalent to a dozen Mount St. Helens is going off at the same time.
I've had some people who emailed pictures, images from HAARP. As you know, they have a website and they have the activity daily. And apparently the activity from January the 11th was not available after some people started taking it. Have you heard about that?
Well, it doesn't surprise me. They've been doing scatter plots. A scatter plot is where you take the activity of HAARP and you cross-reference it against natural disasters that have occurred.
Yes.
And it's really amazing the correlations that they're coming up with. If there was no correlation, then it would, you know, the correlation would look something like a shotgun blast on a big white wall. But it's almost one to one. It's almost a straight line of a correspondence between HAARP activity and natural disasters.
So why isn't there more people trying to prove that there's a correlation? Is it because they're afraid to be called conspiracy theorists? HAARP supposedly is not under the umbrella of the Department of Defense. I cannot confirm this. But if it's used for weather manipulation or for war purposes, wouldn't that fall under the Department of Defense? And if so, having the great people like you and Dr. Nick Begich, who I had on the show a couple of months ago, wouldn't that be futile to pretend that you're overseeing something that it's operating under secrecy, supposedly just to altered the ionosphere to communicate with submarines?
Well, it doesn't pass the smell test, does it?
No.
I have my suspicions, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I tend to believe in much less diabolical activities out there. But when Secretary of State Cohen signed a treaty, not to use HAARP as a weather weapon in 1996, mm-hmm. I thought that was really the smoking gun for me. Whenever the U.S. government signs a treaty saying they're not going to do something, it's because they're already doing it.
It's interesting you say this, because a day or two after the Haiti earthquake, I found the actual article that showed Secretary Cohen signing this treaty. And I thought, why would you have to sign a treaty not to be using this? if indeed it's not being used. But that's a different story. So do you have any suggestions to the scientific community and others like yourself as far as the steps that need to be taken to prevent this from being used, pretending that it's not being used?
Well, I wish I did. I can tell you that I'm fairly confident that when it comes to this kind of stuff, we don't really have a government. We have our elected officials who we think are the government, and then we have a loose coalition of bureaucracies that probably do make up our government, and those bureaucracies work for multi-trillion dollar corporate conglomerates that really are the government. And our elected officials, whether they be congressmen, former governors, senators, or even presidents, can't do anything to stop it. So short of what we call a soft revolution, I really don't know of anything we can do other than awareness.
You're more or less not in those words, but you're saying what Senator Inouye said back then, a government behind the government with its own army, its own air force, its own budget, etc., isn't it?
Yeah, and they're in the business to stay in business. So, my observation is, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but my observation is there's a department called Wars R Us, and they have a stack of contingencies in alphabetical order that can be called up at any moment to keep the army employed.
Now, I think I've heard this before, but tell me what the reasons of this of existing?
You know, I wish I could answer that because, you know, we're at a point as a free people, and more nations are becoming free like us, whether their governments believe it or not, whether their frontline bodies that call themselves governments want to believe it or not. And we're quickly approaching a planet of people instead of a planet of nations. And it boggles my mind when I look at, for instance, the budget of NASA being less than $200 million for 2010, and yet the national defense budget is $1.03 trillion.
Yes.
We are not at war with anyone. We're doing some cleanup of some troublemakers here and there, you know, trying to keep certain religious factions from taking over local villages. But there are no armies with uniforms and tanks and ships and planes that we have to worry about. There's nobody to go to war with. So why is it that the armed forces create enemies for us? They're ghost enemies, just so that they can stay fighting, just so that they can stay ready. I wouldn't put them past saying we're being invaded by aliens and we have to tool up to meet an off-world threat just so that they can stay in power.
I didn't even want to go there, Dr. Agnew, but at the beginning of the show, and by the way, I love your show and I love the introduction of your show. We have Ronald Reagan on the speech that he gave at the United Nations. I believe it was 1988. What you just said about, is there not an alien threat among us? Project Bluebeam, have you ever looked into this?
No, I haven't. I don't get to see everything. I'm interested. You've got my curiosity piqued.
Well, Project Bluebeam can do many things, can create earthquakes. But in reality, and I spoke to a few other researchers, one of them said that the holographic technology of showing things in the ionosphere has been around since the 1950s. And in the 1960s, the United States Navy was going to use it with a submarine parked outside of Cuba to reflect God or some religious figures, explaining how the devil communists were going in and for the religious Catholic people from Cuba not to allow it, but they didn't use it after all. And this has been there since the 50s. Now, we go back to Project Iron Mountain that was presented to President Kennedy, that in order for the economy to continue going, you need always to have a threat. So first, you have the threat of communism, you have the Cold War, then you have terrorism. After terrorism is over, then maybe a natural disaster via earthquakes or a celestial object. And the final one, to unite the world, an alien invasion, a false flag alien invasion. Do you think that's possible?
Yeah, I do. I think it's possible. We as a people, I don't think that there's one person out of 20 in the world that doesn't believe that there are off-world races visiting our planet. I think they just know it. The evidence is overwhelming, even though we don't have a nut or a bolt or a screw or a spaceship to prove it. There's just a knowledge among the people that they're here. We have this concept, and I was in the armed services, as you read in the opening segment. I was in the Air Force, and we were routinely briefed on what is typically called a clear and present danger, or the sovereignty of the airspace over the United States of America and its territories and allies. And we tend to want to maintain that sovereignty. We don't like unmarked ships flying around in our airspace. I can't tell you how many times we've been put on alert in the middle of the night because some stray aircraft drifted across Air Force property. We take it very seriously, and the military mindset, going all the way up to the chief of staff, is that our airspace will remain sovereign, and nobody that's uninvited or unidentified is going to be flying in it. So whether the alien races are friendly or not makes no difference. If they come here uninvited, they're going to be fired upon.
And this is a precarious situation or scenario for the military. If we are not 100% certain of the visitor's intentions, how can we expect the military to stand down? Of course, some people think that all the ETs are benevolent, and there are others who say that that cannot be proven right now. Although I reserve my opinion, I tend to subscribe to that point of view. If we have good and bad on this planet, how can we discount the possibility of that existing in the universe? So I know it sounds bellicose, but if your job is to protect the country as a military person, you have to be prepared and think of all the possibilities. But if there's a lack of communication, since their communication systems, the ETs, may not be compatible with ours, not to mention language, technology, etc., how can we really establish protocols with them in a situation like this without recurring to shooting them down?
Well, there are a couple of organizations out there, one that was founded by Alfred Lambert Weber, that's called Exopolitics.
Sure.
And, you know, he's a good friend, and the Peace and Space Initiative means a lot to me. If we ever get a chance to make it before, make the declaration before the UN General Assembly, we want to do that. Space is really the final frontier off of this planet, and by the way, this planet's extremely rare. For all we know right now, 25,000 light years in every direction, we're the only planet like us where we have liquid water on the surface and we're able to live on the surface of the planet. I guarantee you that life the way we know it doesn't exist on any planet in our solar system because the conditions are not conducive of it. It doesn't mean life doesn't exist on the inside of the planets, but on the outside, it doesn't show promise. We should start thinking like a planet full of people. And I'm really encouraged lately because since 1996, we've been establishing this new neural network called the Internet. And believe it or not, I think most people believe this, the human race is evolving. We are no longer isolated tribes charging across the frozen tundra at one another with battle axes in hand. We can now fall in love with people on other sides of the world real time. And that's changing our planet. It's changing the way we think. It's changing the way we possess things. It's changing our consciousness. And I think that what will happen is this warlike mentality where we have a tendency to guard that which we occupy by simple majority and brute force now, we'll begin to relinquish it. We'll begin to realize that we don't own it at all.
And I think I may have used a wrong choice of semantics. And yes, Alfred Weber is also it's a mutual friend. And what I said about the military being prepared to fire upon on an identified flying object, whether it's from this planet or not. I did it. I was playing devil's advocate. I believe in total peaceful interaction with them. But it's just that we don't know what the intentions are. I mean, let's take our own military. If we indeed have a secret space program and we were going to another planet and we happen to know that there's people living there and we needed a resource from them in order for us to survive, to us, it's a matter of life or death. But to them, we would be the malevolent race, wouldn't that be?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I find it hard-pressed to find Americans anymore who would look at, let's say, an armada of American helicopters flying across the countryside or from one part of the state to the other. I don't think I can find a single American that feels safe when that happens. We don't trust our own military. We don't trust our own government to tell us the truth. When our government tells us that they're posturing warships because they believe Iran is going to marshal nuclear weapons, in the old days, I think 10 years ago, we would have believed them. Now we hear the Iranian government say, no, we're just trying to develop nuclear power because we want to join the modern world. We want to have clean energy. We don't want to burn our petroleum for electricity because it's dirty and it's a resource for us, and we want to sell it to other people instead of use it ourselves. Well, most Americans say, well, how can you believe those Iranians? I'm almost to the point now where I'm ready to say, how can you believe those Americans?
And this is a very touchy area that I really hardly discuss. But let me use this analogy. If you have someone in your neighborhood who has a gun and does not report it and then comes along and sees that you are assembling what looks like a gun, but perhaps is not, and threatens you and says that if you don't get rid of your gun, there will be consequences. Maybe he'll use the gun he supposedly doesn't have against you, even though you have registered your gun and have admitted that you want to use it for peaceful purposes and you haven't hurt anyone. What moral authority does your neighbor have to demand that you get rid of your gun when he has one, does not admit that he does, and even rallies the whole neighborhood against you and threatens you? Shouldn't you have the right to protect yourself from that neighbor, or at least demand that he also gets rid of his gun so that you're even? Does it make sense that your neighbor wants to keep his gun and demands that you get rid of yours? Does that make sense?
No, it really doesn't. And I'm not a proponent for weapons anyway, but I that's just my personal choice. I know people that have weapons, but, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, sooner or later you're going to have to shoot somebody, and that's just not acceptable to me. But that's just my personal standpoint.
And let's leave it there. Some of the ones who are listening may understand what I meant. Now, what do you make of all these strange clouds, the circles appearing over Australia? Do you feel that this could be somehow related to HAARP also?
It's hard to tell. You know, the cloud formation, sometimes they call them cloud ships, and sometimes these are the big rings that you see way up in the sky, sort of
yes.
A dark hole in the sky. They usually play it off as to be, you know, ice crystals or a super high stratospheric shadow that's cast on the upper atmosphere with ice crystals in it. These are the kinds of cymatic patterns that appear in the upper atmosphere when HAARP is being used in a focused manner. The particles that are in the sky, suspended in the atmosphere, whether they be ice or whether they're dust, they have a tendency to arrange themselves in patterns based on the frequency that they're being irradiated with. It's a little like sand forming certain patterns when frequencies are applied to a drum skin, or maybe dye particles floating in water. When you put a certain frequency into the water, then they'll form what's called a cymatic pattern. This is the kind of patterns that are typical when you're irradiating a section of the upper atmosphere with HAARP.
And what I'm referring to, and you probably know what I'm saying, is the cloud formations in Australia. But these clouds are not the ones that we've seen that look like puncture holes on top of a city. These are clouds the size of the state of Texas.
That's about how big they would be.
Yes.
It's easy to focus close range, but when you start pushing it, you know, 3/4 of the way or 5/8 of the way around the planet, it will telescope. It will fan out in rather large patterns. It starts out as a 38-acre facility on Alaska, but by the time it reaches its target, it could be, you know, 500 miles across.
And somebody emailed this question, and you were talking about this, so I'm glad that the person asked. Regarding the depth of the Haiti quake, is it unusual? Is it depth indicative of HARP?
Yes, it is. They have recorded dead dolphins, birds, bacteria, frogs, all kinds of cetaceous life is particularly sensitive to these frequencies. It's now illegal to use sonar along whale paths and you know, like around Hawaii or Alaska or things like that. You cannot use a sonar pings because the sound is so loud that it under the water can damage cetaceous life. But HARP has been used. I don't know if it's been used, but one of the side effects has been widespread death of biological life.
And that's another part. Recently, I believe the last few days, we've heard about dolphins, we've heard about whales, but now octopus everywhere. Octopus just washing off the shore. What kind of effect can somebody have to those animals in order for them to lose their sense of direction, if you will, because that's what's causing them to wash out on the shore, right?
I think that's it, yes. They either lose direction or whatever they're being irradiated with has a species-specific effect on their sanity in the local area.
And what you said a few minutes ago was so interesting when you said that some of HARP technology can actually cause somebody to have diarrhea or to have a heart attack. I mean, isn't the brain communication mechanism between body parts and organs and the brain, is it radio frequencies? And if that's the case, that would be such a magnificent weapon for anybody. If you wanted to take out Osama bin Laden and you know the place where he is and you wouldn't want anybody to know that you actually took him out, just project that array, if you will, and cause any type of death.
Well, it would seem so. I don't know if they can focus it that small. It's not like a Hellfire missile that you can aim with a drone. It's a lot more indiscriminate than that, and you're going to have collateral damage.
Collateral damage. Okay. Okay.
What really struck me as strange about Haiti is the amount of death toll. You know, it was certainly a bad quake, but we've had quakes stronger than that in Armenia, where the housing is very primitive, usually made of stone or stacked clay, and you may get 20,000 deaths. Haiti wasn't an area that was made with terrifically cheap housing, in the sense it wasn't stacked adobe. A lot of it was concrete, a lot of it was concrete and steel, a lot of it was plaster, but there was a lot of wood and a lot of light structures there because, you know, the island regularly gets tropical
hurricanes.
Storms, and so
yes,
they always have new construction around, even though it's not a really, you know, high hurricane standards. The death toll does not belie structural death. Those kinds of deaths come from something else.
Well, I want you to answer the following question when you say something else. But I am from the Caribbean, and I know the construction in the area, and it's a lot of concrete just because, as you well said, when hurricane season comes around, you need to be protected. Now, 200,000 deaths, which to me still sounds small with the amount of damage that I've seen. I have a brother who leads a regional airline, and he tells me that the death toll is probably much more than we've been told. But what did you mean when you said the death may have been something else?
Well, in areas where, you know, you may have had high rises or high density, poor construction, you might see death tolls in the realm of 20,000 or 30,000. But to have 150,000 people die in an area like that with with the population density that that area has, it just seems like it doesn't correlate. There had to been another reason, another cause of death. And I know the Israelis were set up literally within hours. They had a hospital set up there with very high quality equipment, and they were doing a tremendous service there. Unbelievable how they responded so quickly and had such great equipment on site. But they were overwhelmed with the damage that people had sustained from an earthquake.
But again, what's your suspicion? What do you think? What else may have triggered or caused the high amount of deaths if it was not the earthquake?
Well, I guess what I'm aiming at is that if HAARP was aimed at Haiti with great intensity in the frequencies necessary to cause or trigger an earthquake, it might have been sufficient to cause death or cause disorientation to the point where a death could occur to a much higher degree than the earthquake would normally have caused.
So in other words, I'm watching TV at home, nothing happened to my house, but I die because of the effects of whatever mechanism was used. Is that what you're implying?
Or, you know, before the quake happened, maybe they heard the loud bang under the ground and they ran outside and, you know, were right in the path of whatever radio waves or whatever ELF waves the area was being bombarded with.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And is it also interesting, Dr. Agnew, that a day or two before the earthquake, they were having disaster drills, and it's almost as we were having terrorism drills the morning of 9/11. They were having drills the morning of July 11th in London. Now here we are having disaster drills a day before the earthquake. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I love these coincidences. And of course, you know, after the investigation is done, we're going to learn all the truth, right?
Of course, I would hope that you're saying that in a very humorous way, right?
Yeah, I am.
And I hate for people to think that I'm being conspiratorial, folks. We're just connecting the dots here. But they love it when they put the labels of conspiratorial. That's why we say that we are a parapolitical show. But HAARP stands for High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project. But interestingly, on their own website, they claim to be using only ELF, or extremely low frequencies. If this was really true, wouldn't the name of the facility be LARP instead of HAARP?
Well, no, because the frequencies that they're using are only the lacing frequencies. The carrier frequency is in the 2-meter range. The square wave antennas that are on the HAARP facility are tuned plus or minus 10% of a 2-meter wavelength. And I hate to tell people this, but those antennas are specifically tuned to a certain frequency, and you cannot broadcast other frequencies off of those antennas because they won't amplify. They'll destructively interfere with one another on the antenna, and they won't broadcast. That phased array is a high-frequency phased array. The ELF is laced over it, just like the audio music is laced over your AM or FM radio band that's in the megahertz range.
So in other words, they may not be able to change their frequencies to affect different results. For example, I guess you need a certain frequency. Let's say an opera singer, when they shatter the glass, but some others cannot do that just because the person who's singing is the frequency of their voice against the glass and it shatters. I'm not a scientist, so if I'm making a mistake in what I'm saying, but do you know where I'm coming from? In other words, you need a specific frequency to cause that effect.
That's right. The singer's voice is trained to the point where it can hit a specific, very narrow band of frequencies, hold it long enough to where those frequencies can build up in the glass, resonate so violently in the glass that the glass will break. If it was a broader band of frequencies, like, say, my voice, then nothing would happen, except it would be extremely annoying, because multiple frequencies would be broadcast at the same time, making them fight against each other and not transmit so much the exact frequency that the glass needs to break.
Well, folks, we have to take our one and only intermission. We have so much to talk about. I don't know if you know this, folks, but Dr. Agnew has organized what seems to me the greatest geological expedition in the history of the world, the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. We're going to talk about this. We're going to continue talking about HARP. We're also going to be talking about satellites. Why is it that we have satellites that go around the Earth west to east and east to west, and we have satellites that go north to south, but we're not able to see the pictures from the North Pole? I want Dr. Agnew to expand more of this. Dr. Agnew, how do people get in touch with your work?
Well, I have several websites out there. The easiest one to find out about the expedition is to go to the phoenixsciencefoundation.org and click on the APEX link. That stands for Advanced Planetary Explorations. The other way, if they're interested in the books, is to go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. That's A-R-K, like Noah's Ark, arcofmillionsofyears.com. And they can pick up the Ark of Millions of Years trilogy, which also comes with two of the books in audio for free.
Great. And we also have links on our website. Folks, don't go anywhere. You cannot miss the rest of the show. This is Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to Veritas. Don't go anywhere. Thank you very much for listening. We're going to talk more with our special guest in our members section. Head on over to our website, veritasshow.com. Click on subscribe and join us in the members area to tune in to the second part of this great show. We'll take a short break, listen to some music, and we'll be right back with more.
this is Alfred Weber, and you're listening to The Veritas Show.